You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Vane, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. Thank you for joining us today on Leaders and Legends. We're with Ryan Vaughn, someone who has held numerous positions of authority, influence, and quite candidly, I don't know that anyone has done any of those jobs better than he has. Thank you, Ryan. Well, you know, when you think about your contemporaries, right, and I think I'm about 10 years older than you, I'm 51, you're 40, and you think about the folks who you've worked with and whose orbit you've been in one way or the other, I just don't know that any of us our age, on the Republican side especially, think any more highly of anyone than they do you, whether it's I talked to Okeson about you or Ballard or anyone, Dudich, all of our friends, you're just kind of universally like, okay, this guy has got it. And we appreciate your time.
Well, that's fantastic and very kind. Happy to be here.
Well, you currently helm, and I want to talk about sports first, and then we'll go back a little bit, the Indiana Sports Corp. It is one of the most impactful organizations in the city. Tell us a little bit about what it does and what you do.
Yeah, the Indiana Sports Corp is a really special institution for Indianapolis. It was founded in 1979 and was actually the first sports corporation in the country. So the whole notion of creating an organization like this to attract sports organizations and sports events to your city didn't really exist in a specific intentional way before that. And we were founded in 1979 really to address a problem that most major cities in America were having, which was this massive suburban flight and deinvestment in the urban core, and sort of the fall of cities. And the idea was, the founding fathers, the Jim Morrises, Michael Brownings of the world, Ted Bohms, came together and said, hey, we need a specific strategy aimed at revitalizing our downtown or keeping it vibrant because it's the core driver of our state economy. And sports is a good way for us to do that. And so, you know, we kicked off in the late 70s and really got, you know, the state, the city, philanthropy with the Lilly Endowment and corporate leadership to invest in building facilities and attracting organizations to downtown. And since then, it's been just a tremendously successful strategy, of which I'm just lucky to sort of be the man leading the effort now.
And 79, for those of you who aren't familiar, it was really on the very beginning of, and you correct me if I'm wrong, the sports emphasis, tourism convention emphasis of downtown of Indianapolis. Was it formed specifically to win a particular event? I think it was 1980, the Final Four was here when Louisville won the NCAA championship. Was it formed like around that?
Well, in 1979, Congress passed the National Sports Act, which actually created what you now know as national governing bodies. So USA, fill in the blank, gymnastics, football, sure. Many of these organizations were created. And so one of the purposes of the Sports Corp was to be the organization that would attract these newly formed companies, nonprofits in sports, to choose Indianapolis as a place to locate. And they did that very successfully. We're still home to USA Gymnastics, USA Football, USA Diving, USA Track and Field, some of the largest Olympic sports. So I don't think we were formed around a particular event, but there was a recognition among the corporate leadership and civic leadership that there was a need for an organization to sort of specifically focus on handling things like attracting those events or organizations.
And when you, right before we started recording, you talk about how much travel you do in the first quarter of the year. How many cities or states do you travel that have the same organization? And what do you hear about Indianapolis? One of the things that I've asked all the guests on the Leaders and Legends podcast is, what other cities and states and leaders in those places, what they say about Indianapolis, because obviously it's dramatically different than what they said about Indianapolis 50 years ago. Sure. What do you hear about the city and how we do things and our people?
Yeah, we enjoy an incredible reputation in the world of hosting major events, sports and otherwise. We really do have a great history. We have an infrastructure here of professional people like the Sports Corp and Visit Indy, but we also have great volunteerism, really unmatched volunteerism. It is the exception rather than the rule. In most other cities, when I go and visit or I attend these major events, there's always a talk about the struggle they have with getting a 50% turnout rate for their volunteers for these major events. And, in the Super Bowl, we had 3,000 people that registered to volunteer that we didn't have a job for. Right? It's the exact opposite problem. And it's really, I think it probably dates back to the Pan Am Games in 87. The community has just really bought in to this mission and really supports it in a big way. And we also really have the ability to work together that is uncommon in other major cities. The corporate, the city, the state, other philanthropy that come together to really rally around an event. In other cities, there's a lot of turf battles. When I went out to Dallas for the Super Bowl before ours, you couldn't get Dallas to talk to Irving, to talk to,
right.
They're different governments. They didn't like each other. They were constantly jealous of one another. The public safety didn't work well together. All those turf wars, none of that exists here. Part of that's the brilliance of Unigov,
sure.
By the way. You only have to deal with one unit. But part of that also, too, is just sort of the ethos of the Midwest and the way we work together, I think.
Did you find, because I want to follow up on that, but before I forget, you talked about the Super Bowl. How much has the fact that, I mean, you'd have to be horribly cynical and jealous not to say that Indianapolis took the Super Bowl and put it someplace it had never been before, literally and figuratively. How much does that help you, or how much does it happen when you go to Minneapolis or Cincinnati or St. Louis where someone goes, Ryan, I came to the Super Bowl in Indianapolis and I simply can't believe what you guys did. How much does that help the image of the city?
Extraordinary. Really, really extraordinary. I mean, especially from a media standpoint, Final Fours, we'll have about, 2,600 credentialed media from around the world. A Super Bowl is probably closer to 9,000, right? So these are people that, it's one of the biggest challenges we face as a community. It's very difficult to get people to come here who don't know anything about Indianapolis or Indiana, but once they do, they fall in love with it. And so having a moment where people were desirous and compelled to be here professionally because they were covering the Super Bowl was huge, because they were just absolutely blown away by it, and they still talk about it to this day. The Super Bowl is the most recent example, but I referenced the Pan Am Games. It's funny, even in the sports world today, how many people still talk about how great those Pan Am Games were relative to other Pan Am championships that take place.
And that's come up before, particularly in our podcast with Bill Benner. We're here at Leaders and Legends with Ryan Vaughn, president of the Indiana Sports Corp, former president of the Indianapolis City County Council, and former chief of staff to Mayor Greg Ballard. That came up before in some of our other. And it was funny, too, because I was stationed at Fort Ben Harrison going through AIT, going through journalism school, and we had to move out because they were housing the athletes there. I don't know which ones. And literally no one, we didn't know what the Pan Am Games were. It seems crazy now, but at the time, we just had no conception. Why do you think the Pan Am Games made such a huge difference? Because Bill Benner made that same point, that really put Indianapolis on the map.
I think it was the volunteerism and the community engagement. It was thinking through, we were not in a place, I obviously was 9 years old, so I'm talking in history here, but we were not in a place where we had a sports corp like we do today with 25 full-time professional event people working on this. We had community volunteers that came together and really owned all of this and recognized very quickly that if we wanted to make it special, in order to be successful, we were going to have thousands of people in the community engaged in what we were doing. And that seems to be sort of the starting point of this commitment to it. And when you get the community involved in what you're doing and they get to see, the athletes from across the country, you give them a platform to sort of demonstrate that Hoosier hospitality, you own it more, right?
Sure.
You as a community own it more, and it becomes this, self-rewarding thing where volunteers have become super important. I mean, you feel good about yourself and about your community when you're out serving it, right? And so I think that platform that the Pan Am Games gave us was just huge, because there were tens of thousands of people that volunteered. Really incredible.
And I remember not traveling per se, but in the Army when I was stationed in New Mexico, everybody comes, you know, from other parts of the country. And it was weird too, because I remember on race day, 1988, I could watch the race live because it's not blacked out in Las Cruces, New Mexico. But when the people who came up and would talk to me and you'd say where you're from, their only reference was the 500. That was the only thing they had, really. And now there's so many more. Right after, I believe, the Big Ten championship of a couple months ago, the Big Ten football championship, Mike Greenberg from ESPN tweeted to his, 2 million followers, literally 2 million followers, Indy is the best big game city in the country. How does that make you feel? Does that help you sell Indianapolis? And is that like, wow, that's the kind of validation we need to be able to market Indianapolis for all these other events?
For certain, it helps us sell the city. And that validation, it's actually part of our strategic plan, is to find ways to seek that third party validation that, we're arrived, we're the best, we can do it. Because you're always, you always want to fight with a little bit of a chip on your shoulder. And we're,
You're battling the big boys in right. places like Orlando and Chicago and New York and L.A. and San Antonio.
Yeah. And, Dallas, Atlanta. There's a lot of big cities out there, 2-3 times our size, competing right alongside of us for these events. And so whether it's fair or not, we always have to walk in with our resume and these third-party validations from people who experience all of these events in all these cities and say, look, we might not be your first choice sort of unconsciously, but after we sit down and talk to you about what we've done historically, trust us that you're going to have the best event you could possibly have in Indianapolis.
And what's coming up? There's an unprecedented number of terrific events, really kind of starting with the Big Ten Championship, football championship that's here every year for a while. But the next 5 years, talk about what's coming to Indianapolis.
Yeah, it's really an incredible lineup. One of the daunting challenges I had when I started this job was it was post Super Bowl, right? I started 4 years ago. Super Bowl was in 2012, and everyone was saying, "Okay, Ryan, welcome aboard. What's next?" And there's not a whole lot of what's next when you've just hosted a Super Bowl.
Well, and you also had to follow Alison Malenka, memory serves, is
still following. We'll ever be following Alison Malenka.
She's singularly talented, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, the answer to what's next is everything, candidly. I mean, we'll be hosting the 2021 NBA All-Star Game, followed 6 weeks later by the 2021 Men's Final Four, followed several months later by a Big Ten football championship, 4 weeks after that, a college football national championship, and a few weeks after that, Men's Big Ten basketball tournament. So collectively, those five events in 13 months are going to have equal to or greater impact than the Super Bowl had from an economic impact standpoint. And so really exciting. Some of these events are very new to us. College football, we've never hosted. Some we haven't hosted in a long time. The NBA All-Star Game, the last time was 1985. And some we're fortunate enough to sort of be on the regular calendar for with the Men's Final Four. So really, really great stuff.
So I'm someone who doesn't understand or finds it infuriating that we spend all this money on sports and all this money on downtown, and why aren't we spending money on X, Y, and Z? What's your...
So you're a city councilor. This is the rule you play.
It's possible. Or I could be a senator or rep Kosciuszko County or something. Right. But I've said this in every podcast, I think, so I'll say it very quickly. When I was a kid, I was born in 67. I only came downtown to watch Dick the Bruiser. There was no other reason to come downtown in the 70s. I lived downtown. You see kids, parents, bikes, dogs, strollers. It's phenomenal how much it's changed. But there are still people who say, why do we spend all this money on sports? We don't get anything from it. It's just a plaything for millionaires. Why aren't we filling potholes and hiring cops? Your argument would be?
Yeah, so from a preliminary matter, there's 81,000 people that work in the hospitality industry in Marion and surrounding counties. So, that whole industry has existed and grown substantially because of the investments we made 40 years ago around sports. Hosting major sporting events has brought the city national, global attention in a very positive light. You know, it's literally, physically redeveloped our downtown in a way that's vibrant and connected. So, I mean, you can go from any of these major stadiums to all of these hotels. I mean, go back to 1979. How many hotels were downtown? You know, one
is the exactly.
answer. Yeah. We now have all of those rooms available to us, which supports, you know, business traffic. It supports, you know, traveling for conventions. Obviously, it supports the sports industry.
Would there have been a reason to build a new airport?
No.
If we weren't a destination city for all these events?
Absolutely not. Yeah. And would we have attracted companies like Salesforce or, you know, Emphasis if we didn't have the vibrancy in our community that was appealing to the talent they need to fill their own workforce? And the answer to that is no, right? So these are all dominoes, all investments you have to make in order to be a city which is attractive for investment other than the taxpayer dollars we were just talking about. I also think it's important and often misunderstood about the true nature of the investment in sports. You know, the Capital Improvement Board, which, you know, owns Bankers Life Fieldhouse, Lucas Oil Stadium, the Convention Center, Victory Field, is largely funded through taxes that are generated from the activities that they host, right? So it's a ticket tax, or it's a tax on hotel rooms for the events that they host, or a tax on a car rental from a visitor coming in to attend. And so, yes, they are tax dollars by their definition, but they're not the tax dollars that we use to repave roads or hire police officers. Those are two totally different streams of revenue. None of our income or property taxes are going to fund those sporting activities or those convention activities. Our core income and property taxes go to fund the operations of government, the core operations of government.
And, you mentioned Domino before. And it's actually just now, I was going to actually kind of use that same metaphor. Is it the Pan Am Games leads to the building of Hoosier Dome, leads to the Colts, Peyton Manning, all these things? I mean, you get the sense they're just simply all connected, that with one of those things, not one building block pulled away, that the Jenga of Indianapolis Renaissance in the last generation just doesn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we weren't aggressively chasing newly formed Olympic governing bodies in 1979, we would not have been able to host the National Sports Festival in 1982. Had we not hosted the National Sports Festival in 1982, we would have had no resume to host the Pan Am Games in 1987, right? So it just keeps going and going and going. The same is true with organizations, right? So we were such good partners to the national governing bodies that allowed us to compete for another very, very important institution, the NCAA.
Exactly.
In the mid-90s. And what they've added to our sports economy is remarkable. Not only is it all the men's and women's basketball events that we've hosted, but there are 54 NCAA championships taking place in the state of Indiana, the entire state, over the next 4 years. That's an incredible economic boost for the
Absolutely.
Entire state, let alone just the city of Indianapolis.
Is it hard to convince people of this? I mean, are they just like, well, okay, well, whatever, but these guys are worth billions and they don't need our money, or, you know, I don't see the rowing championship, therefore it has no effect on my life?
It's not hard to convince them if you can sit them down with an open mind, right? Yeah. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're out there seeking knowledge and wanting to be informed, but if you know, we all have seen people in the community that look for something to be against as a way of defining who they are, as opposed to investing in the issue and trying to figure it out. But there's no solid argument against what we have done in Indianapolis. Now, I will say, in other cities with different models, sometimes the investment could be fairly questioned. You know, if you're using core investment dollars, you know, to build a stadium for a billionaire, 40 miles away from the core of your downtown, just because, you know, you want the Dallas Cowboys to be the Dallas Cowboys, even though they're not in Dallas. Well, they're a bad example because he built his own stadium because he could.
Sure.
But, you know, there's stuff like that is worth arguing about. But what we've done here and how we've made sure that every investment in sports and infrastructure we've made has leveraged the downtown in a positive way and added to it a positive way. I mean, we're the example they use across the country, and you're seeing it across the country. Cities are starting to bring those stadiums back into the core of their downtown. They're reinvesting in these strategies of connected, walkable, authentic, which we've had for 40 years.
Well, it was either Mayor Ballard or former Indianapolis Star columnist Bill Benner or both who mentioned to us that the initial plan when they were going to build Market Square Arena was to build it out by Lafayette Square, out in Pike Township somewhere. And it was Jim Morris and then Mayor Richard Lugar who found federal dollars or a way to use federal dollars to build it downtown. You talk about a game-changing decision. I mean, if Market Square, of course, it wouldn't have been Market Square. It would have been named something else out there. Then that changes the entire dynamic. Do you find that the fact that everything is so walkable, so connected, so downtown, that that's something that sells Indianapolis, especially if people had already been here? And like, yeah, I get it. It's February, but I never have to leave a heated space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's and we cultivate that specific experience because it is a huge competitive advantage. So when Mike Greenberg is here, he loves it because it's a 2-minute walk from his private party at 1933 next to St. Elmo's to his suite to watch Northwestern play at the Big Ten Football Championship. And 70% of that is inside, right?
Exactly.
And so it is a huge advantage and something we always highlight in partnership with Visit Indy when we're competing against other cities to host these events.
Two other questions along that, and then we'll move on to some of your other experiences. I remember talking to P.E. McAllister, who was chairman of the Capital Improvement Board for decades, mostly under Hudnut. And he said that when something needed to be done for the city, for downtown, associated under the umbrella of the Capital Improvement Board, there was no politics. There was no R. There was no D. That everybody, I mean, shave off 5% on each side. But everybody agreed. Everybody pulled in the same direction. There was no grandstanding. It's pretty fractured political times in the country. Do you still find that to be true when it comes to the Sports Corp and what we're trying to do here?
Kind of. You know, One, I think people, and I'm not accusing PE of this, the man has a better memory than I do, and you know, he's more than twice my age, but I think people remember successes more romantically than they probably actually occurred. So,
and it was different because the Republicans were so in control of everything, basically.
I do think there's still a shared spirit of investment in the core of our downtown and in our sports strategy, regardless of the political aisle. It just occurs differently now, I think. I think it's, candidly, I think the quality of our elected officials was greater then from an understanding standpoint of how these things work and why they're important from an economic standpoint. And so I think the people that still appreciate that, still work hard on it, both from them and now, work together to get stuff done. It just happens either more quietly or it's just harder. But yeah, sure. I still think it gets done.
If what does Indianapolis so project out 10 years or after the 5-year run that you're about to have that you described a few seconds ago, what does Indianapolis need to do better to continue this incredible streak of victories? Do you look, we need to think about this, or man, we need to do this better, or hey, you know, San Antonio's doing this. Let's figure out how to do what they're doing.
Yeah, I worry about soccer in a big way. It's such a growing sport. We really need to support the growth of soccer in Indianapolis. And whether that's, with the current Indy 11 proposal and investing in that and building it out, I think that's going to be really important. Our success and Visit Indy's success, we're tied at the hip. We need one another to be successful in order to sustain all of the retail and entertainment amenities downtown. So when I'm not having a major sporting event, the folks at Visit Indy need to have the NRA in town.
Sure.
So that there's a constant flow of business and a capacity there to build new hotels and reinvest in the ones that we have, for sure. I think we need to, people don't appreciate how bold of a city we were for 30 years. They look at us as sort of this, city stuck in Indiana in the middle of the Midwest. It's very conservative, all of which was true, but we were actually very progressive in the way that we attacked some of these policies around sports and around investment. And I think we need to adopt a little bit more of that and own it. So whether it's leaning into things like esports or getting really aggressive with whatever the future of the downtown mall looks like. We continuing to invest in public transit, really focusing on quality of life of the surrounding neighborhoods of the core of our downtown. You know, all of that just needs to be really elevated, and people need to sort of really, I think, just kind of look way out there and be on the bleeding edge of what's coming, as opposed to, I feel like we took our foot off the gas a little bit on some of these issues.
Will we ever reach the boldness level of building a stadium with no team?
Well, I mean, we have a soccer team. We can't seem to build a stadium for it. So.
Well, they're trying to make it happen. Right, yeah, multiple. Right, full disclosure, I've done the PR for Ursaal and Indy 11 on a few things. So, I mean, I think they're making as good a push as you can possibly make at this point.
No, I agree. And I don't know. I think that's just a question of leadership going forward. Who's going to make that push, and what's it look like? And even the discussion of building a stadium without a team, that was really a discussion about expanding the convention center, right?
Exactly.
And so it was a discussion about benefiting the entire city year round, not specifically about luring the Colts. And so I think as long as people have that mentality of what's in the best interest of the city that can be sustainable and grow, then you have that foundation upon which you can be bold in the way you work.
One last question before we move on, and it's going to serve as a bridge. Hopefully we're working in reverse chronology for your career, so forgive me. You're listening to Leaders and Legends podcast. This is Robert Vane sitting down with Indiana Sports Corp President Ryan Vaughn. When you hear, and I heard it when I was in the mayor's office, and you heard it when you were in the mayor's office and probably in other places, we can't do everything for Indianapolis, which is heard all the time in the state house, in the media. You say,
we're not asking you to, right? Let us do it for ourselves at the state house. I mean, this notion of local control, it's like a peacekeeping missile, right? This is not real, okay, right? if they would unlock the revenue streams and diversify them for the cities and give them the autonomy to create their own destiny, sure, some would fail, but some would, like Indianapolis, really succeed, I think. The revenue streams for the city from a government standpoint are very prescriptive, and there's very little dollars for us to do initiatives that we would like to do on our own. So, and I also say, it's just not true, right? I mean, there are 22 donor counties. And when I say donor counties, 22 counties in the state of Indiana that contribute more to the state of Indiana than they get back. And actually, Indianapolis and Marion County is number two on that list. The poor folks from Evansville down there are our number one contributors for some reason. But
and people don't realize that. Indianapolis throws off a lot more than it takes in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And candidly, the challenges we face are all different. We're 400 square miles, but at this point, we're almost entirely urban. And the rest of the state, most of the rest of the state is very rural. And so we need a different path. We need our own autonomy in order to continue to be successful.
The first Monday in November 2007, you were running for re-election, if memory serves, as a member of the City County Council. And if I had told you, Ryan, in about 5 years, you're going to be chief of staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, your response would have been, knowing that I don't drink alcohol, by the way, your response would have been?
No way. Are you kidding me? Right? I mean, I'm assuming this question, even though it's that day and time, is me knowing, not knowing that he was going to win, because I didn't believe he was going to win that night.
He appeared on the podcast, and he was his amazing self. And I told him flat out, I didn't think you had a chance in hell. Like, I thought he was going to get clobbered. I was the comms director and communications director of the Indiana Republican Party. I volunteer helped him because he didn't have any money. I thought he was going to get lit up. And it was Kyle Walker, political genius that he is, who told me about 2 weeks out that he thought this guy had a chance, thought the council was going to go Republican for sure, but thought that Ballard had a chance. And I just remember going, you can't be serious. And I was working Channel 8 that night, and was working with Shella and Toby McClamrock and Susan Williams, who, as I recall, used to be president of the Indiana Sports Corp. And we were all just stunned. As someone who's very well versed in politics and as an former elected official, tell us about that night and kind of what you thought was happening in the city that led to the probably the biggest upset in Indiana political history.
Yeah, that night for me is surreal. It's, you know, we all have those moments like, where were you when, right? And you remember specifically what was happening to you. And I had a little campaign party up in Broad Ripple for the folks that had volunteered for me. And so I was up there for about an hour thanking folks. And I told my wife, Heather, I said, hey, I'm going to run downtown and thank all the folks in the county party. I mean, they, you know, were super helpful here. They need to be down there. They can't be up here. So I drive downtown by myself, and I get on Mass Avenue, come down College, turn on to Mass Avenue. My phone rings, and it was a lawyer who's a big-time Democrat, Greg Hahn, actually, who I was working with at the time. And he says, Ryan, hey, I just wanted to call and congratulate you. You know, he's giving me the whole, you know, spiel, like, great, great job. You guys did an incredible thing. And I said, I said, Greg, thank you very much. I said, you know, the district sort of leaned Republican. I certainly enjoyed an incumbent advantage. I said, we worked hard. And he just interrupted. He goes, Ryan, I knew you were going to win. I'm talking about the mayor's race. And I said, Greg, what are you talking about? He goes, I just left Democrat Party headquarters. You guys won the mayor's race. And I said, are you kidding me?
There are no language restrictions on the Leaders and Legends podcast. And no. It certainly calls for expletives.
Right, yeah. And I'm, you know, I literally pulled into a parking spot on Mass Ave and just finished the phone call and hung up the phone. I thought, that's not, there's no way. I didn't even believe it after he told me that they were. So I drive back down. I finally get to the Marat at the time and walk in. And I'm walking in as Greg Ballard is walking up behind Carl, and I stand next
Carl Brizzi, former Marion County prosecutor.
And I walk in, and Mark Fisher is standing by the bar. And I walk over to Mark, and I get a drink. I go, is this about to happen? He goes, yeah, I have no idea what we do now.
There was a lot of that, for sure. Yeah. It was that was Tuesday night, and I got a call Wednesday night about, hey, can you come help this guy and be his press secretary for the transition? And we talked about this a little bit with Mayor Ballard, that I was getting emails and calls, and I think maybe texts were around then. I don't remember, but like, oh my God, he's going to ruin the city. He's going to destroy everything that we've done, which was equal parts snotty and equal parts kind of ignorant. But there was a little bit of like, we don't know this dude. And I'm like, you know, he did grow up here. What do you think of his 8 years of mayor? I mean, I think it's fair to say, without being condescending at all, he vastly outperformed expectations over 8 years. As someone whose political mind and antenna is as good as anybody's, Ryan, just what did you think of the job he did?
Extraordinary, honestly. I knew him a little bit from the campaign trail. I was obviously running my own campaign and engaged at the council level, that's a whole different story that night. But my expectations were, man, we got a lot to learn, and big challenges ahead of us. I mean, huge operating budget deficits, crumbling infrastructure, crime on the rise, a police department that had been sort of given to the sheriffs. You know, there were all of these things that needed to be addressed that were huge issues, and I was anxious. I was anxious about what team he was going to put around him. I was anxious because I had been on the city council for all of over a year, and I was now suddenly one of the most senior members of the new Republican Majority Caucus, right?
I remember you walking into state party to talk to people about state party to get, because you replaced someone like in a caucus, right?
I did, yeah. Bradford, yeah, Jim Bradford.
Oh, Jim Bradford, that's right, that's right.
When we rallied as a new majority caucus, the only member of our caucus who had ever served in the majority was Bob Cochran. He was literally the only counselor that knew what to do. And so he naturally became our president year one. Everybody came together really with the right attitude. And then the thing that I think sticks out the most about the mayor, and I knew this when I was council president and worked closely with him, but I got to live it when I was his chief of staff, is that and you know this as his comms director, like, there's nothing more than he hated about than having a discussion about a message, right? If you came to him and said, you need to do X, Y, and Z because people will say this about you, you had already lost the argument. You had to go with him and say, this is the right thing to do, and this is why we should do it. And that was always what drove whatever he did. And I used to tell people when I was chief of staff, they'd come to me with a problem, and I had this silver bullet theory. You know, if you and I disagree, you know, we both have one other boss to go check with, and he'll make the decision. But don't you dare walk out in there without knowing the answer to this question, which is, what's the right thing to do? Because if you walk in there and say, well, this is what so-and-so will say if you do X, you know, he's going to be furious.
Well, and he, you know, that's 1,000% correct. I mean, and doing you know, messaging for Greg Ballard is like trying to grow hair on Mr. Clean. I mean, it's so, sorry, Mayor, if you're listening, because I bet you probably will listen to this one because it's Ryan. Yes. But, you know, he was not treated well by the media in the 7 campaign. And, you know, they didn't think he was going to win. And, you know, for good reason. I mean, anyone who says that Bart Peterson was not a good mayor is, I think he was a terrific mayor for 95%. And then, you know, what happened in the summer and fall of 07 took everybody by surprise. I mean, it took almost everybody, I guess, by surprise. But the mayor always asked, what's the best thing for the city? What's the best thing for the city? And it led him to make some really bold decisions. The transfer of the water utility probably being number one. You know, if Greg Ballard doesn't greenlight it, we don't go after the Super Bowl bid. And so the one thing that I thought that was underrated about the mayor that people didn't factor in when they discussed him was how much he had traveled. He had been to all these huge cities throughout the world because of his career in the United States Marine Corps, and he saw how Stuttgart did it and how London did it and Paris did it. And he also had young kids, you know, really smart, college-educated kids. And those two things, I think, really drove him. And talk about how you interacted with him on that. With regard to what do young people want, right, and what are other cities doing really well. And I think that he's not given enough credit for bringing that vision from other places here to Indianapolis. Is that a fair statement, yeah, or no?
Absolutely fair statement. You know, he was sort of painted as this massively inexperienced, you know, borderline sort of like ignorant of city government candidate and mayor, referred to as the accidental mayor, right? Not even credit for doing anything to be, you know, progressive about being the mayor. And you hit on something which I think certainly surprised me, and candidly, I didn't give him credit for before he became mayor, and certainly my boss, is that global experience fed so many policies that, you know, candidly weren't very Republican, but they were very very necessary for the city and its success. And you know, bike lanes is a great example, you know, of my ignorance and his brilliance. You know, when I was on the city council and president, we did this wastewater utility transfer, and you know, it netted about $400 million for us to then reinvest in infrastructure, and we're ready to, you know, plow down roads and repave them and build trails and sidewalks, and you know, he comes down with this philosophy that we're not going to build a major street thoroughfare without a bike lane. I'm like, what are you talking about? No one in Indianapolis rides bikes. You know, it's freezing. You know, half the time here, we don't have a strong bike culture. And here we are 8 years later, and I ride 12 miles to work every day. Right? So,
and I've seen you on your Pacer bike share. Right. Going from meeting to meeting.
Right. It was transformative. It was something they got pushback for. But he had seen that bike culture in other cities. Throughout the country, Georgia Street's a great example. You know, Georgia Street gets built, you know, for the Super Bowl, and is part of the vision around this. You know, bringing federal dollars again to kind of make this happen, and you know, and you could hear him talk about similar places in other major cities and how excited and how convinced he was it was going to be transformative. And by the way, how right he was. It was, you know, the home of the Super Bowl Village, which had never existed in a Super Bowl before, is now a required element of every Super Bowl after.
Yeah, Benner said that. So yeah. You completely redefined what's expected of cities when they host Super Bowls.
Yeah. That it actually reminds me of a phone call I had with the mayor, too. When I was chief of staff, he was traveling overseas. He was in Barcelona, and he was standing on the street that Georgia Street was basically modeled after. And he was there receiving an award for an Innovator of the Year award. And I'm talking to him, and he's sort of describing the street. And he's like, this is exactly how Georgia Street was built. I'm like, that's great. I said, what are you and Winnie doing tonight in Barcelona? He goes, oh, we're going to KFC. He literally went to Kentucky Fried Chicken in Barcelona, Spain.
Yeah, the food bill for the Ballard administration wasn't particularly high.
That's what I loved about him. He was like every guy you know and every guy you want to hang out with, but he was also so sharp and so innovative. In ways that you wouldn't expect.
And people would, you know, I would say this, his reelection in 11 to me is more impressive than his election in 7. You know, you can run up behind someone and, you know, clock them on the back of the head, knock them out and then run away. That's one thing. But to go toe to toe for 4 years and fight, you know, which is a formidable political machine in Marion County, the Democrat Party, and win 3 years after Barack Obama carries the county by 120,000 votes with all these new registrants. Now, whether they choose not to turn out for mayor, that's one thing, but they're there. They're on the rolls. For him to win 11, to me, is more remarkable than his win in 7. Am I right or wrong?
I absolutely agree. Yeah. And I think, you know, his character is what stood out and made that possible. Certainly his accomplishments. So he had done a lot with regard to public safety. He had done a lot regard to infrastructure, but the old playbook didn't work, and the old playbook was, hey, I'm going to call this guy corrupt.
Exactly.
And no one believed that Greg Ballard is corrupt.
It takes a lot to convince people that a Marine Corps officer is on the take. Right. Like, it takes a lot, and I've said this 100 times, if Greg Ballard, when he was mayor, so not now, but when he was mayor, walked in a restaurant, you wouldn't know if he was the mayor or he just got done pitching underhand softball at the over 50 league. And that's part of his body type. Sorry, Colonel. And part of it is his demeanor, his personality. I think actually quite candidly, in a different way, Governor Holcomb is the same way. He's so laid back, so personable, so easy to talk to that he connects with people in ways that someone who's more programmed and maybe a better or more experienced politician perhaps can't.
There's no switch. He's the same guy in a boardroom of 50 corporate executives as he is in the foursome with his golf, you know, his Marine Corps golf buddies. He's the exact same guy, right? There's no switch that turns on and you get that sort of like phony political.
And as a comms guy, it's like, well, can you flip the switch? To your point, there is no switch.
Right.
Before you became, talked about City County Council, but you also had another kind of formative experience we want to talk about for a few minutes before we end the podcast. You're listening to Leaders and Legends with Indiana Sports Corp President Ryan Vaughn. You were a prosecutor. How did you get into that job, and how did that job help you in the jobs that you've had since then?
Yeah, so my goal growing up was to be, the world's biggest, baddest, richest civil litigator. You know, I fall in love with all those movies of people pounding courtroom tables and flying in private jets. And, you know, as a kid on the West Side, that seemed like a pretty good life to me. And so I went through college and law school. And in law school, I thought, well, if I'm going to be a civil litigator, I really need to get some trial experience, right? I want to come out and right out of the gate and, you know, go conquer the world. And so there was a program that allowed you to be what they call a certified intern. So you were still in law school, but you could practice law under the supervision of an attorney as a prosecutor. And so I thought, well, I'll go do that. So I signed up, ended up becoming a certified intern in the prosecutor's office, and just loved the work. I mean, it was so fun being in trial, sort of wrapping your head around these criminal cases. That office, I have a lot of respect for the folks that still work there. I mean, you're handling literally hundreds of different cases at any given moment,
and the pay is not commensurate with your responsibility.
No, I mean, when I graduated law school, which was in 2003, and became a full-time deputy prosecutor with the generous reward of $29,000 a year,
and you literally have families like depending on you for justice, like
absolutely,
this guy killed my son, or this, you know, this man did X to my daughter, or whatever, and so it's not without its own pressures.
So I was there 4 years and kind of graduated up the ranks from, you know, public intoxication cases to murder trials. And I had an experience one fall month where I literally did 3 major felony jury trials of the same village pantry on the east side and thought to myself,
well, you don't get certified as a village pantry until on the east side until there's a felony committed. As someone who used to live at 16th and Linwood.
Yeah. So at that point, I said to myself, you know, hey, I've sort of reached the point of diminishing returns on the growth as an attorney. And so it's time for me to leave and go, you know, accomplish my lifetime goal of being a rich private lawyer. And so I left and I went into a private firm. And 6 months into it, I just wanted to eat a bullet. It was terrible.
Boring or just not the reward that you thought?
Two things that I've discovered about me that experience taught me that have really guided every decision that I've made professionally going forward. The first was I went from having 90 major felony cases that I was working on at any given point to working on 2 construction litigation cases for a year straight. And so I was much, much happier trying to spin as many plates as possible, being confronted with different fact patterns, moving quickly, being in court, than I was stuck behind a computer reviewing documents, doing discovery. I need to be busy with a lot of things at once as opposed to just solely focused on one at a time. And I'm better professionally when I'm doing that. The second, and this is really the one I think has been the most instructive for me, is I didn't appreciate while I was a prosecutor how emotionally rewarding that experience was for me until I couldn't do it anymore.
Really?
There was something about, you know, sort of serving the community, feeling like you were chasing justice, sticking up for these families. That's really the moment the light bulb went off for me that, hey, I've got an actual heart and passion for community service here that I've got to find an outlet for. You know, I called then elected prosecutor Carl Brizzi and I said, look, I need that again. Like how, At this point in my life, I wasn't at all involved in politics. I was just practicing law, trying to get rich. I called Carl and I said, hey, I need that. Is there, you know, are there cases I can take on the side? Is there a way I can help? He's like, Ryan, that's illegal. You should know that. I said, oh, yes. He goes,
you're at the track that's right. that day yeah, that's at law right. school?
He said, but you could work on my campaign. You know, I'm going into re-election and you could give that a shot. And so I said, sure. So I, you know, spent evenings. I knew I still needed to stay as a private lawyer and develop. I spent my evenings working at the county party, you know, putting stamps on envelopes, knocking on doors, you name it. Got to meet a whole new network of people who had that same kind of passion that I did around trying to help the community. And, you know, one thing led to another. That led to replacing Jim Bradford on the council and so forth and so on.
And you meet the best. It gets a bad rap. And you know, you can't really defend. And by it, I mean politics about everything. But whenever I speak to a college class, which I just did a few days ago, actually, along with a couple others, Megan Robertson, who's your close friend, and Laura Beck, who's my close friend. The last thing I told the class of college kids was there were 2 things. One, don't lose your sense of humor because you're really going to need it. And number 2 is don't be afraid to be friends with someone on the other side of the aisle because you never know. The friends I've met in politics, Republican and Democrat and Libertarian, Mr. Spangle, are amazing. They're some of the best friends I've ever had in my entire life or will have. And you know, your point about being involved and the people you've met and your path. And I know your friends because a lot of them are the mutual friends. And whether it's Melissa Thompson or Jessica Higdon or Megan Robertson or Jason Dudich or the list goes on and on, they're absolutely wonderful people. And I somewhat feel sorry for folks who are so jaded or turned off about politics that they don't get involved because they miss that opportunity.
Yeah, I agree 100%. When I speak to college class, I tell them 2 things. One, if you care at all about your community, don't think that politics are a bad way to get involved. Politics are a great way to get involved. Figure out where you stand. And by the way, like, you don't have to be the extreme left or the extreme right. You could be like 90% of us are kind of right down the middle on a lot of these issues. The second thing I tell them is take a job in government right away because you get to understand your government in a way that the people that don't work in it can't. And if you take that job right away, you're already poor, so you're used to not making any money, so that's good. And you get tremendous leadership opportunities and a tremendous network when you work in government because so many people, so many industries touch government in some way, shape, or form. You just learn a lot. And I was glad I did that early, even though I didn't stay in the criminal world, criminal prosecution world, just to be clear. even though I didn't stay in that world, that was my path to politics, which has, to your point, really given me just incredible life experiences.
We didn't mean to, as we close this part of the Legions and Legend podcast with Ryan Vaughn and move on to the five questions, I didn't mean to skip over the fact that you went to Wabash, along with every other Republican I know, or pretty damn close. But I want to ask one other thing very quickly, and it's personal, and you can answer it as shortly as possible. My understanding is that you are married to your high school sweetheart. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
What is that like?
I'm luckiest man alive. It's like winning the lottery on the first ticket. You know, we met in junior high. We started dating, if you could call it that, when we were 15, and we've literally never been apart. She's been a super special part of my life. All the way through, you know, college, she went to all of my swim meets. I mean, I didn't even want to go to some of my swim meets. you know, she worked tirelessly while I was in law school to help support us and pay for our mortgage. She's been an incredible friend, companion. We have spent far more of half of our lives together. So to even think about trying to compare it to not being with her, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, we appreciate the fact that you are spending your Valentine's Day with us here at Leaders and Legends. And Ryan's talking about Heather Vaughn, and she's an incredibly engaging and warm person. And on behalf of all of us who know you, I think it's fair to say that we would never mind if the words First Lady were put in front of Heather's name. And yeah. You can choose the office. Thank you, Ryan, for going through your career and everything that you've done, and it's not even close to being finished. And we've come to the five question segment of Leaders and Legends. We ask the same five questions of everybody. I recently changed the first question because I didn't like it. So we're going to start with that. First question of the five questions, Leaders and Legends podcast. What was your first job?
First job was a lifeguard. I also, at the same time, was a blimpy sandwich artist.
You weren't blimpy in those little red shorts, though, were you?
Yeah. Off of Out Speedway, blimpy sandwich artist.
Because you grew up on the west side, went to Ben Davis, I recall, is that correct? And I grew up on the east side, and we thought everybody from the west side was basically one step away from juvie, which is interesting because juvie's on the east side.
That's right.
The second question is, what was your first concert?
MC Hammer, opening act, Vanilla Ice.
About 1990?
Yeah, I have no idea what it was, but that is unfortunately true.
So is it more impressive that Heather stayed with you through that than all of these meetings in law school?
I actually then saw Vanilla Ice for a second time for a $5 cover at a bar in Texas about 6 years later.
If you could recommend one book to anyone to read, which book would you recommend?
Ooh, that's tough. That's real tough. I think my favorite book is probably still Seabiscuit.
Oh, really? Why?
I just love the story. It's sort of the horse that no one wanted that trained and became dominant, and that time in the country when the economy was terrible and people were starving, how they could sort of rallied around Seabiscuit, and he of course is tragically injured, and they write him off for a second time, and he comes back and beats Man of War. It's just, to me, it's just a constant sort of fall down, get back up story, and it reads really, really well. I just thought it was great.
That's a great choice. Is the movie as good as the book?
Never, right? Yeah, the book is fantastic. Yeah.
If you could witness any event in history, like be there when it happened, which event would you choose?
That's already happened, or that
any event in history that's already happened. And be there, by that I mean not watch on television, but actually be in the room, on the street.
Yeah, I think I would like to watch everybody sign the Declaration of Independence. I mean, that's a pretty cool, seminal moment in world history, let alone American history. And just sort of hear the discussion and the thoughts and arguments that went around, why those particular principles were adopted and why these men were so focused on making it a reality.
And you forget what they put on the line. Like, they all knew they would get hanged.
Absolutely.
If they lost.
Yeah, they were committing treason.
If yeah. you could, last question of the five questions, if you could have dinner with anyone in the world for a couple hours just to chat, who would you choose? Whom would you choose?
My wife, I think. Yeah.
That's Greg Ballard's answer.
Is it? Yeah. It's tough. People get busy to carve out time and spend time with your loved ones. Yeah, if we're asking about famous people,
we should just have a disclaimer. You can't choose anyone you're related to, because the mayor, Mayor Ballard thought about it for 30 seconds and he goes, okay, Winnie.
yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I always feel like I've learned something really special when I am listening to Mitch Daniels talk. And I think if I could just have 2 hours one-on-one with Mitch and get his thoughts on leadership and government and civic duty, I just find him incredibly insightful.
Well, I would imagine that he's going to be an answer to that question more than once as we continue on these podcasts. He's probably the best communicator I've ever seen in person,
yeah,
for sure. When he gives a speech, you walk away going, well, why doesn't everyone believe that? Like,
exactly.
That's so incredibly like brilliant. Yeah. Why don't we all just do that?
And how come that never occurred to me?
Right. That's exactly right. It would be unfair to call Ryan Vaughn the best leader of his generation in the city, because he's quite simply one of the best leaders in the entire city, regardless of generation. We all look up to you. We're all very happy for your success, and we're looking for more. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Leaders and Legends podcast.
Well, I appreciate it, and I'm sure the mayor said this because I know he believes it, and I believe it too, but all of the success that I've had personally or professionally has been a result of just a great network of people like yourself and all those folks that you mentioned that have just been supportive and encouraging. And so I'm blessed to be here, and hope not to let you guys down.
Thank you very much. We'll hope to have you on again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.